pinpoint him. When they eliminate him, there's somebody else who's going to replace his position. And that person, they have to study him all over again. And that will take time. And that means dragging on war. And that means more casualties for the Israelis. And true, the new leaders sometimes do not basically radical. But what they have is like they would be more adamant at taking revenge. And that causes Israel more problems. And in that sense, we could see that Netanyahu putting sticks in wheels when it comes to negotiations hurts the army more
than
anything
else. Could
they
learn from the mistake of their predecessors?
No, I don't think the Israelis are going to learn from anything, because they are an entity that lives and thrives on killing the natives, killing everybody, eliminating anybody.
The resistance leaders talking about.
Definitely. So at the end of the day, when they eliminate resistance leaders and there are new ones coming, they take them as an excuse to launch further wars to take over more land and kill more people.
Okay. And of course, with all these factors that we're highlighting throughout the report, but it's not stopping Israel from committing more assassinations.
I mean, well, the thing
whatever
is...
Whatever they feel it's necessary.
No, definitely. But as I said, I mean, the Israelis will take the excuse that the new leader is more radical to launch further wars, to kill more people, to take over more land. Remember that the current Israeli government, for the past, let's say, a year and a half, and even from the past, all Netanyahu's governments were a coalition of right-wing groups. Right-wing groups, they don't care about anybody else in the Israeli entity. What they care about is creating greater Israel. Mm-hmm. And that's their goal. So, like, basically, they want to launch more wars. They need wars to actually expand.
Okay. Israeli social media, however, reacted to the escalation of the war of destruction in Gaza City. Here are some of the comments.
Tom Yigael: Netanyahu no longer hides the fact that we are turning into a Spartan state. His statements that we have no choice but to wage war on Gaza are propaganda. What happens in our lives is not destiny, but the result of policies that can be changed. Hudi Argov: Netanyahu has brought Israel into an escalating disaster that will destroy Israel if he continues destroying Gaza. Roni Itam: what do you think will happen to Israel's foreign relations when it enters another round of war in Gaza that could last until 2030?
Despite the global and Arab campaigns of condemnation and denunciation of the Israeli aggression on Qatar, Hebrew media still focuses on the importance of this aggression for the Israeli entity with pride that is expressed by a former Knesset member. Leila, do you agree that the timing of this aggression on Qatar, in one way or another, is linked to the war on Gaza City coming to an end?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you have to understand one thing. There are certain people who believe that Qatar was complicit in this attack. There is a growing tension and restlessness among the populations of the countries that claim that they support the resistance, and they haven't seen anything from their governments doing anything on the ground to support that resistance at the end of the day. And if you're going to tell me that the Americans who gave a green light to this operation and the Israelis who actually flew over, even through their missiles, none of those were detected, the missiles or the planes, by the radar system in Qatar, that tells you one thing. Either somebody from the inside did what you call kill switch on all the radars and all the air defenses, or they were complicit in the beginning. And that means the Qatari leadership in front of their people will come out and say, like, we're victims as well, so you cannot go against us. You have to go against the Israelis and everybody who basically put it this way. Those people actually support their narrative by saying, and I actually tend to mm-hmm. go with that narrative, that the Israelis, if they wanted to kill the first-year leadership, the political leadership of Hamas in Qatar, in that residential area that's not highly fortified, they would have done so easily. But they
didn't. So they didn't want to?
Well, look at it. They managed to assassinate Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in a bunker that's totally fortified. They could have easily, they took out Sheikh Saleh Al-Arouri in an apartment inside the Beirut southern suburbs with two missiles. They couldn't take down the whole leadership.
So what's the point?
It gives what you call, it absolves the Qatari leadership in front of their people. That's one thing. The other thing is that it directly pushes the current political leadership of Hamas towards accepting certain pressures when it comes to the negotiations the American offer.
And they want the Qataris to pressure Hamas, especially when it comes to the captives? That's what
you're saying? The Qataris would tell Hamas leadership, political leadership, we cannot protect you for so long, you accept the rules and that's it. And this is how Qatar would walk away as the peacemaker. Hamas will have to cave in because they don't want to lose their lives. I mean, we're talking about the political leadership, not the military leadership over here.
Yeah, but will Qatar agree to this?
Well, look what happened. None of the air defenses nor the radar system actually stopped any of those missiles. But everybody made a commotion, including Qatar, about the Iranian missiles that only hit Al Adid military base.
Do you think that's a Qatari decision or it's an American decision to stop these radars?
To think that it's a Qatari decision, that means Qatar has sovereignty over its own decision-making process, and this is not true. When you have the largest U.S. Air Force military base in the region, in Qatar, and when you have another U.S. military base in Qatar, and you have the Americans telling the Qataris since day one until today who they should meet with or negotiate with, that tells you that the Qatari decision-making process is not sovereign as they try to claim.
Okay. Does this aggression, Leila, really mean that Israel is an undisputed regional superpower, in your opinion? Or could this end up being a catastrophic mistake for Israel by that will lead to its international or regional isolation?
It's not undisputed. It is disputed by Iran, by the resistance in Lebanon, the resistance in Yemen, the resistance in Iraq, the resistance in Palestine. But it has the upper hand because it flies with impunity over international law and anything else. It is protected by the Americans and NATO powers. So at the end of the day, it's not a regional superpower. It's an enabled power in the region. We saw with the Iranian hits against the Israelis during the 12-day war, the Israelis couldn't stop any of those hypersonic missiles. Even the Yemeni missiles, they can't stop them. So that means they're not super as they try to claim, but they have a lot of supporters, and those are the ones who are defending it.
And what did they lose by this? And that's when the major thing that I was asking. This is, will this lead to its regional isolation? Because there are a lot of reports coming in speaking about that.
Well, sadly, the thing is there's a growing international isolation from the populations themselves, mm-hmm. but regionally it's not. It's actually going the other way around, and that shows Arab complicity. We saw a meeting between the Organization of Islamic States, the Arab League, and basically the Gulf Cooperation Council, all in one summit, major summit happening in Qatar, to support Qatar against the attacks that happened against it immediately, unlike what we saw with the case of Qatar,
right? Again,
so, mm-hmm. but like when you look at the whole situation, the Arabs all are speaking about the peace process with the Israelis when the international community population are speaking about cutting
off. But nothing caught your attention in this Arab summit that took place. We've seen how these Muslim countries join together in one force against the Israeli act, and we've also seen the involvement of the Egyptians.
No.
And also Iran, who was designated as an enemy by these countries, they came together as one force.
No, they came together to support Qatar over the table, but they all spoke about the peace process. They all spoke about if Israel wants peace, we're ready to go and talk. None of them said we're going to take measures to stop the Israeli entity. Did they take any measures on the ground or say that we're going to take these measures or anything? Did they name any measures? No. They only condemned, and this is what expected, and they basically broke the whole thing.
But the tone was different, especially from the Egyptian president this time around.
Does he dare say anything else in front of his constituency? Talk is very cheap. Again, talk is
very
cheap.
He never spoke in that language, Leila, before.
Okay, so basically,
don't you see it as a development in the political speech?
Well, do you think that the Palestinians are going to survive on statements?
Mm-hmm.
Action is needed. So if Sisi doesn't open the borders, allowing the Egyptians to march towards Gaza, or at least have the Egyptian army stop the Israelis from taking over the Philadelphia corridor, which they actually handed over without a single bullet shot. Mm-hmm. And then he comes over and he cries over Palestine, or he cries over what's happening, or he denounces the Israelis. How is that going to help the Palestinians? How?
Okay, do you see it as a beginning for a new era on how to deal with the Israelis? It begins with a political talk and then ends up with the actions that you're highlighting?
No. The way I see it is basically that those people have already normalized ties with the Israelis above and under the table. They're mm-hmm. doing mere theatrics in front of their constituency.
Yes.
And going forward, they will basically try to normalize ties as much as possible.
Okay. However, the Israeli aggression on Qatar, although supported by all Israelis, may lead to disrupting security cooperation between Tel Aviv and some Arab states, especially the normalization states like the UAE and Bahrain. Do you think that the Israeli fear of disrupting security cooperation, of course, between the occupation entity and some Arab states or the normalization states is justified at one point?
There's no Israeli fear on this matter. Above the table, they will say, we fear that our relations might be disrupted, but they have these Arab states in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
They've already signed agreements with them. They have the GCC money pouring into investing in the Israeli entity and Israeli-owned companies. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars worth of investments. Those people are not going to back off. But there's something wrong with this comparison. They're comparing an assassination on the ground that happened in 2010. That's the assassination of Al-Makhouh in Dubai, right? The international outcry was because the Mossad agents were pinpointed as using forged, what you call, foreign passports, Canadian, Australian, etc. That's why the Australians and the Canadians and Austrians, like basically I think there was another nationality, mm-hmm. they were angry about it because that jeopardizes their own citizens who are traveling with normal passports to the UAE, among other places, because everybody will look at them, oh, are you part of the Mossad or not? Mm-hmm. So that case was completely different than the case of hitting Iran, where the Israelis said, we did it, they did it above the table, and they had backing from international community. I mean, like there would be a denouncement, but not pulling out, let's say, disrupting what you call diplomatic ties, like we saw between Australia and Israel at one point. Mm-hmm. However, when it came to Dubai, I mean, this time, the only country among all of the GCC nations was not the UAE, but the emirate within the UAE, that's Dubai. Because of what happened in Qatar, Dubai decided to suspend Israel's participation in November, this year's November air show. So at the end of the day, this is kind of what we call, if you do something, we're going to hit you on the hand.
Yes.
But that's the maximum.
But another scenario says that maybe the UAE sees it as a good thing what happened to Qatar. Maybe it's a good chance so that they can have their own personal benefits of what they're dreaming of.
I highly doubt that they would see any benefits. I mean, like, if you remember, there was a long row between the UAE and Qatar between 2015 and 2021. And they put Qatar into
isolation.
But
there was also a lot of disputes between the two countries.
Yeah, but things they put...
Especially when it comes to regional political
matters.
Yeah, but
they put Qatar into an isolation. The Emiratis, the Saudis, and the Bahrainis, they put Qatar into isolation during that period.
Yes.
But then they mended fences, as you call it. And remember, those family, like, the I'm going to call them the imperial families, the royal families of the GCC, they all are all intermarried. So at the end of the day, they will solve their differences at one point in time. What I'm looking at the moment is that they want to show Qatar that they support it. Mm-hmm. Above the table, so they take these measures like the one we saw with Dubai, but I highly doubt that these measures are going to evolve to the level of cutting ties with the Israeli entity. Otherwise, they would have recalled their ambassadors from the Israeli entity. I mean, UAE has an ambassador.
Yes, but another scenario says that the UAE, the Israel, gained some kind of a green light from these countries, and that's what allowed it to actually move further.
Well,
and attack Qatar.
If the Israelis did not understand the mentality and psychology of the Arab states, well, it wouldn't have done this.
Okay.
They know that there's not going to be any reaction, and they know that petty grievances reign supreme when it comes to these matters. So they will do whatever they want, and the Arabs will continue to fight among each other.
Okay. However, the Zionist aggression on the port of Hodeidah and the swift of Yemeni missile response was the focus of commentary in the Hebrew media, where one commentator paused at the speed of the Yemeni response to the Israeli attack. Actually, what struck me here was the question of the anchor about the humiliation and the humiliation faced by the Israeli entity when, of course, Yemenis retaliated immediately on the very same day when the port of Hodeidah was attacked by the Israelis.
Well, the thing is, it's not only a humiliation to the Israelis, it's also a humiliation to Qatar and every other nation that got hit or received any harm from the Israelis and never retaliated directly. At the end of the day, the Yemenis understand that the only language that the Israeli entity as a colonial entity understands is power and force. So by them retaliating, the Israelis actually got slapped in the face because they couldn't at any point stop the past missiles, and they couldn't destroy what you call the capabilities of the Yemenis in terms of continuing to throw missiles. Even if they intercept the missiles, that means disruption of the economic activity in the Israeli entity because everybody will jump to the shelters no matter what. Mm-hmm. That's a disruption of a few hours, and that cost them a ton of money.
Okay. Now, moving on to the tensions and relations between President Trump and India after he imposed costume tariffs of 50% on it. This has caused Israeli concern over economic and security cooperation between the entity and India. Will the deterioration between the relationship between the United States and India automatically lead to the deterioration between Israel and India, especially now that Israel is suffering from economic isolation?
Well, not necessarily, and I would love to see where the economic isolation is. I mean, the Yemenis are the ones enforcing what you call maritime isolation when it comes to trade, maritime trade on the Israeli entity. But they still receive basically goods from Turkey, from other European nations, and the U.S. through the Mediterranean at any point, through shipment.
Netanyahu even spoke about isolation.
They can speak about isolation all they want. They use it as an excuse to show the world that they are victims. Watch it. Like, oh, we are isolated. This is anti-Semitic. they try to play the victim on anything and everything. When it comes to India, India owns the port of Haifa. This is something that not everybody knows. The Israelis sold port of Haifa to an Indian company, and it's being run by a Chinese company that under the table has direct ties with the Chinese government. So when you look at the whole situation, this nagging on TV is one thing. Reality on the ground, it tells you that they have good relations with the Indians. The trade corridor that India announced that passes through the GCC.
It's not related to the good relationship with the United States.
It has nothing to do with the United States at the end of the day. And when it comes to tariffs being imposed on India, they will be renegotiated no matter what. The Americans, at the end of the day, they need India as well. So when it comes to Trump, look at him. He threatened several countries, and then they all negotiated.
But why is this a madness here that's expressed in these reports? They're furious about this deteriorating relationship between the U.S. and the Indians.
How much you want to bet that he doesn't know anything about the economy? I mean, talk is very easy for people.
But they're frustrated.
No. Like, he's frustrated because he doesn't understand economic ties. When the Indians, the GCC, the Americans, the Israelis, and the Egyptians, along with the Europeans, have all agreed on the trade corridor that goes from India through the GCC to Eastern Mediterranean, Israeli entity, all the way to Cyprus and Europe. That means everybody had agreed to it. It's isolated from what you call political law or anything else. Mm-hmm. The Indians still want that trade route because it will bring them tens of billions of dollars. The same thing goes for the Israelis, same thing goes for the Europeans. The Americans will benefit from that because now they have presence in the Eastern Mediterranean region, and everybody's going to be happy. When it comes to the tariffs, it's something that the American president is using as what you call show business. Mm-hmm. He's trying to enforce what they call negotiations to renegotiate the tariffs on either side, and that's it. It's not going to impact the Israelis at all.
So this fear is not justified?
No, it's not. And when you hear the Israelis saying, like, oh, we fear that India is being pushed into the hands of Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, mm-hmm. they are one of the biggest trade partners with the Israelis are the Chinese. So the Chinese are not their foe. They are their friends at the end of the day.
Okay, Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief, MENA Uncensored, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Israel is committing a live stream genocide, yet Israeli sporting teams and players have not been declared global pariahs. They continue to participate in club and international competitions with the full backing of governing bodies. As bodies are bloodied, starved, and martyred in Gaza by the IOF, Israeli teams attempt to whitewash their genocide. Nowhere is this starker than in the world's global sport, football. Calls to FIFA and UEFA, the sports governing bodies, have fallen on deaf ears despite public revulsion at Israeli actions. But Israeli teams may soon be shown the red card. A brand new initiative aims to target those at the very heart of football and bring about a revolution through sports. Leading the campaign is Ashish Prashar. He is a former Middle East Peace Envoy Advisor, political strategist, and speaker. Thank you very much, Ashish, for joining us today to speak about this. Why football? You know, why are you trying to address the genocide through sports and specifically through football?
Well, there's a saying that there should be no normalization in abnormal times. And what is more normal than people playing football, right? We think about how that brings people together culturally through, you know, fans, through games, through moments in life. And it's really important that if a state is committing a genocide, that it has no place in that. You know, the if you look at the big impact from the South African apartheid timeline, the sports boycott had a pivotal impact on them dismantling the apartheid regime. And it's because it was isolation. But also, moreover, sport connects with everybody. Unlike any other cultural thing like art or music, pretty much everybody engages in what they would call the Colosseum mm-hmm. in every way, right? Mm-hmm. And no other sport is bigger than football. Yeah. And with football, you trigger all the other sports, right? You know, if football goes, the Olympics go, if football goes, all the other sports mm-hmm. follow. And that isolates this genocidal entity. And that's why it's so important that we follow this path.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, amazing to see how different countries, different cultures, you know, when we talk of the big football clubs, how, you know, there's such attachment in different mm-hmm. parts of the world. Ashish, tell us about the initiative itself. You know, what is it about and what are you trying to really achieve?
Well, look, you said it yourself in the opening. FIFA mm. and UEFA have ignored calls to throw Israel out of football for 2 years. Mm. I mean, it even goes longer. You know, Israel's been sports washing their crimes through sport and culture for decades, right? Campaigns have been running for decades to kick them out of football. They've failed. I mean, they've raised awareness, but the reality is you have an immoral being at the top of FIFA who's best friends with Donald Trump right now. Mm-hmm. The idea that he is individually going to throw Israel out, I think, is a non-starter. So we have to think of different, more radical tactics, mm-hmm. right? And there's a saying in the Black Panthers, like, use some radical imagination. We know we can't get the top. Israel's also invested heavily in protecting their place at FIFA's table. So where do we go? We follow something that just happened in recent history. When Russia was thrown out of football, they weren't thrown out because FIFA and UEFA have morals. In fact, the only consistent thing here is the head of FIFA has no morals, and he doesn't care if white children or brown children are being killed. He kicked them out because on the second day of the invasion, 12 European countries, led by Sweden and Poland, boycotted Russia. They wouldn't play the Russian national team. They wouldn't play their club teams. And for that reason, they forced UEFA and FIFA to suspend Russia because football couldn't continue. It actually impacted the integrity of the game. Mm-hmm. And we are following that same model. We are starting a coordinated campaign to target European football federations and, moreover, the heads of European football federations. So we are asking the public to flood those football federations, protest them daily, protest the chief execs and presidents of those. Because here's the other kicker. Most chief execs and presidents of football federations have executive power, meaning they can actually just boycott a nation, club, or a player if they deem it's the right decision. So that's individuals really, yeah, have this power, yeah. And I want to make that really clear.
Yeah.
You can target someone who is an accessible person in your country and demand they take action to get these genocidal players out of your country, get that genocidal team never step foot on your pitch, and make sure that genocidal state is not normalized anymore in your country. So you should be going out there to demand your federation act.
Which is quite surprising, I mean, at least for me, you know, countries, for example, like Spain, where we've seen a lot of pro-Palestinian, you know, movements and things happening, yet we haven't seen anything from football. I mean, does it surprise you?
I mean, it doesn't, right? There's a lot of money in football, and I'm sure that's played a massive role in this, and I'm sure there's lots of pressure coming down from FIFA on federations not to do anything. But also, I think actually the bigger reason is nobody knows they can do this. Okay. You know, how many people actually knew that there was a boycott of Russia before the FIFA suspension? These federation heads, including in nations like Ireland, Norway, and Spain, who are supposedly Palestinian allies, they get away with the fact that nobody knows they can do this. Most football fans don't know they can do this. Most footballers don't know they can do this. I've talked to many people in the football space who didn't realize that that's what caused the suspension in Russia. Mm-hmm. And these people are experts. And they were like, oh, I didn't realize that. And that is the most powerful thing here. Now, we are tired of protesting and nobody listening, right? Gianni Infantino is the same as Trump or Starmer. He's sitting in neon Switzerland, doesn't care that we sit in stands. Mm-hmm. In fact, he even made a point of moving his North American headquarters to Trump Tower. If you ever wanted a sign that he doesn't care about our protests, he stuck his flag in the ground and said, this is where I stand. So what do? We go after accessible targets, people in our countries that actually might have said they care about Palestinians in some cases, especially at a government level. In societal level, I think everyone in Europe we targeted is on our side. We are the people, and we have actual power here to make sure that they know that we will not let it be unknown that they've been sports washing genocide this entire time. So as we launch this campaign, everyone's name will be public who has this power in each football federation. And like I said, we demand that they act to boycott Israel, because there's no way this genocidal entity, who now it's been declared by the UN that it is a genocide, should continue to participate on the pitches of Europe.
So apart from fans, which I believe are the ones you're targeting, you know, who else are you mobilizing? And how would you suggest people support the campaign?
People of conscience. This is not a, like, hey, you have to be a football fan. By the way, I think everybody, in a weird way, is, it's, like I said, it's the only global game, right? Everybody kind of watches it to a degree. But it's people of conscience. Like, I don't really believe that there's any difference between a football fan, a union member, a political strategist, or whatever, right? This is an opportunity to actually knock one of the core pillars out from the Israeli regime. This is an opportunity to knock the culture pillar out. And then the economic pillar falls, too. Isolation causes more isolation, right? If we keep going down this path, if we knock this one. By the way, this is an easy win. If we sustain pressure on these football federation heads, everywhere they go, not just at the federation building, their homes, their schools. This is important because they, at this point, are complicit. The heads of federations in Italy, France, Spain, Ireland are complicit because they have known for the last 2 years they can act. And if they claim solidarity with Palestine, they've done nothing to show it. Norway recently said they will play the game with Israel and donate the funds to Gaza. I mean, yes, Norway, an allied nation, and their head of the federation wears a kefir, but she knows deep down she can boycott Israel. Like, and the reason we're doing this simultaneously here, because I want to be a realist about this, because, yes, I've said that about Norway, but Norway are not going to give up their World Cup place, right? But the reason we're doing it across Europe at the same time is so they provide each other cover. Yeah. So you did this once, as 12 nations. Do it again, as 12 nations, or 9 nations, or 8 nations, or however many of you decide to do it together. Because I guarantee you, UEFA and FIFA are not going to punish all of you as a collective. Could you imagine an environment where they throw Spain, the number one team in football, out of a World Cup for Israel?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the collective part of it, I think, is the most effective, you know, strategy. But what would you suggest, you know, people who are listening probably and thinking, you know, I want to support this initiative. How do they put pressure? What do they do?
Obviously, the easy tools to use are, right, emailing the federation heads. Calling the federation offices, making sure your demands are met. But organize, organize, organize. They are scared of you. There's a French saying, nous sommes le pouvoir, we are the power. Came out of the 70s and the 60s when the unions took control of the countries. You are powerful beyond measure. And we need to organize things every day. Don't just rely on football fans and the ultras that have been organizing the first wave of protests. Palestinian movement should be targeting them. This is a win. We're always saying, how can we win? What are we going to do to make a change immediately, right? They can make this decision tomorrow. Yeah. They don't need to vote. They don't need to consult. They don't need to do anything. Apply pressure every day till they break. And Israel will not be playing those international games in October against Italy and Norway. Israeli club teams will not play in European competitions, and Israeli players will be banned from stepping foot in Europe. But it only works if you apply pressure. They are scared of you, and they know you mobilized. You mobilize at a target that is accessible. Not prime ministers and presidents sit behind gates that don't care that what we say on the street when we protest on a Saturday, they're not even there. Be there. Every time fans get together for a game, they're already mobilized.
Yeah.
So now direct that anger to them and then go to the game.
Yeah.
And if they end up at the game, protest them at the game. These federation heads travel to games.
Amazing. And honestly, it's a no-brainer in a way. I mean, it's not just that there is a genocide going on. They're specifically targeting, you know, sporting facilities. 800 athletes in Gaza have been killed, have been murdered, you know. Why has it taken so long, Ashish? Why has this mobilization not happened earlier? Why are people not aware of these things?
Lack of radical imagination in some cases, I think. I think there's a twofold answer to that. I think you want to believe that there is moral. At some stage, something will kick in with individuals that they've seen enough, they've got to do something. But you have to look at the leadership of the West right now, and our governing bodies in sport are a reflection of that leadership. They're soulless. Like, they don't care about the value of our life, right? So if that is the top, we've got to be radical of how we use different tools and techniques and targets to get what we want to be delivered here, which is ending this genocide, right? And I think sometimes certain organizations move like oil tankers, and they're stuck on the path of a campaign that they believe in. But unfortunately, that campaign's never going to work by itself. So we're taking it one step further. I believe in that original campaign. But hey, it's not working. So now what else can we do? We take it one step further. That original campaign mobilized fans, got them to care about Palestine. But guess what? Now let's deploy the fans in a strategic way, in an actual strategic way, to actually get Israel booted out of football, get them boycotted by every European nation.
Do you think there's enough of the fans and, you know, the public in Europe to support this?
Yes. We don't need new people to join this movement. They're already there. You've watched us march in our millions, right? And you've watched football fans chant in their tens of thousands at stadiums. In fact, Paris Saint-Germain's fans, who I'm going to call out directly, started the chant about, you know, Nous l'enfant de Gaza. We are the kids of Gaza. We are the children of Gaza. Right? They've led that chant, and people sing it all over Europe, you know? And I think this shows you there's a deep connection, a deep solidarity with regular people. I think the problem with our movement so much is we obviously rely on celebrity to amplify something, right? And this is the case with many movements. Malcolm X always used to say that, you know, celebrities are puppets and can be controlled opposition. The actual power to make this happen isn't Mohamed Salah, isn't another famous footballer. The power to make this happen, what they're really scared of, is the people. And if the people are there every day outside that federation will buckle and break.
And when it comes to football, I mean, you can't overestimate, you know, the power of the fans who actually make football clubs what they are. Who else, Ashish, is involved in this campaign? You know, organizations, people behind it?
And people behind it, you know, there's amazing human beings behind this who've given up their time to work on this. But organizations, like we have the ADC in the United States, the Hind Rajab Foundation, you know, we have Code Pink. People who know how to organize, by the way. People who are doing radical things, like chasing, you know, IOF soldiers around the world. Shout out to the Hind Rajab Foundation. That is radical work. You know, we're not going to wait for an end of a genocide. We're going to do it while it's happening. We wanted to put a group together who actually have radical imagination and want to chase an end goal and actually deliver something. You know, the problem with some of our institutions in this space, they were built for a timeline that was slower, right? They were built on the models of apartheid South Africa. I believe in BDS, but the reality with that, it was built in an environment where white South Africans were not exterminating the black population because they needed them as a labor force. The difference here is the Israeli occupation wants to exterminate every last Palestinian, and they're doing it at the quickest rate that they've done since the beginning of the genocide right now, because they've got it on multiple fronts, the starvation, the bombing, everything. They are killing people en masse, but we're operating like an oil tanker to stop it. So we need to be more radical, faster. The flotilla is a great example. Yeah. That is commitment to change, you know. People trying to do all sorts of different things in Europe, like challenging embassies and ambassadors at this point. So why are they not doing something? That is radical attacks. We need to keep going down that line. We need to put pressure on individuals who have power to change things, right? We have the ability to change this. We need to shut down cities.
Yes.
Look at the French. Only last week they had a general strike. They're having another general strike this week, shutting down economies. Yeah. Right, if we really want to do this, we need to be more radical. No more playing the long game, because there will be no one left to play the long game for.
Absolutely.
And the reality with this, this can work tomorrow. If we did this for 3 or 4 days this week, these federations will bend and break. And the ones who are Palestinian allies have no reason not to say they're not going to boycott. Calling out Norway here, calling out Ireland, calling out Belgium's now new government who's saying they support Palestine, calling out Portugal, Spain, Italy, who are the public, have been mass mobilized on behalf of Palestine, where unions are threatening national strikes. They are speaking for Palestine as we speak, and they will deliver justice. So those guys, take all those protests and anger at your federation, because they will break, because the public is on your side.
Some people might say to you, you know, you should not mix politics with sports. What would you say?
Muhammad Ali. Sport speaks to the people. There's nothing else to say. What, anyone not speaking out about the genocide in sport is a coward. You know, there's a lot of silence in sport. And it's, how are you not a human being? Also, what athletes don't realize and what they need to start realizing, especially in sports like football, is you're more powerful than the organization. They need you. It is a disgrace that some of the most high-powered footballers in the world, who control millions in endorsements and everything else, they're not going to take that from you. They need you. Mohamed Salah is a great example. The Premier League going to sanction him because he speaks on behalf of Palestine? Not a chance in hell. They use him to market to the entire continent of Africa. Like, they need him more than he needs them.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is,
this is all about humanity. You can't separate these different aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, politicians have been involved in sports. You talked of, you know, the South African example. There wasn't the kind of lobby that is really, so the Zionist control. So this is not, you know, these are not separate components. These are all parts of what makes our lives.
Look, anytime there's war crimes, mass atrocities, genocide, you have to look at every, you have to look at everything, right? It's not just about military and politics. Culture normalizes evil entities with us. And culture is where they should not be welcome as well. Because you isolate them. They are a pariah. You have to isolate them. Sport is part of life. You have to ask why people divide everything. Why do they categorize everything? They do that. So it's harder to actually change anything. In the end of the day, whether you're a footballer or a politician, you're a human being. Whether you're a fan or a union member, you're a human being. And if you care about other human beings, you should be acting right now. Right?
So this, obviously, this is all about stopping the genocide, you know, and it's about Palestinians. But do you think this could be a crack for bigger things if we were able to succeed with this? Because there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of power, like you say, controlled in football. But if this cracks, that there'll be bigger repercussion than just stopping the genocide.
I mean, my focus on this campaign is the genocide. And the goal is to make Israel, the Israeli occupation, as isolated as possible to stop any form of normalization. Like I said to you at the beginning, football is the first domino. The Olympics will go. Other cultural institutions will go. Eurovision is going as we speak. Art will go. Other things will go. If football goes, the cultural dominoes are huge. It's why you always go after what they invest in. You don't go after something they don't care about. The reason they invest so heavily in football is they know the domino effect. And we need to go after that with everything we have because we know it will topple a lot of other things. And if we do that, they will be isolated beyond measure. And then it starts to affect the economy. Mm-hmm. My only goal here is to stop the genocide, like anybody else I know who's working on anything right now related to Palestine. And if this puts a nail in the Israeli occupation's coffin, that's great.
What would determine, you know, the success of the campaign, and what's the timeline you're looking at?
We want them to act as soon as possible. There is no timeline. The goal is to have them kicked out tomorrow, yesterday, right? The success here is as many European nations as possible boycott the Israeli occupation's national team, their club teams, and ban their players from ever stepping foot in Europe again. And the goal is to have as many European nations do that. And we believe we can get half a dozen to 10 to go in the first couple of weeks. But it requires the people, because the people are the power. And when we start recognizing that, stop relying on celebritification or, you know, big social media accounts to do the work for us, we'll realize that we can change anything we want.
Thank you so much, Ashish. It's amazing that you are, you know, working on this campaign. And I'm sure, you know, everybody will support it. We, of course, will continue to monitor and spotlight this important initiative. Thank you all so much for being with us on this special program. And once again, thank you again, Ashish, for both doing the initiative and for sitting down with us to speak about this. Thank you. Goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, The Humble Chairman. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on IB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so The Humble Chairman, so this is about people or persons who are very gracious to others, no matter their position. And obviously this is something that we know. We should not treat people differently based on their rank, their wealth, let's say their ethnic origin, their nationality, their skin color. And obviously this is something that needs to be sort of borne out in the way we treat people. So just because someone has a, let's say is a very famous person, is wealthy, has a high position, does not mean we speak to that person differently compared to, let's say, a beggar on the street, compared to, for example, the man who maybe comes to our house to take sort of meter readings and so on. And this is something that we see in obviously all the martyrs and the holy defense, to the extent that I think there was a story about one of the famous martyrs from the holy defense, Dr. Mustafa Chamran, who was obviously, he was already working, he was in the ministry building in Tehran or in the presence building, and some people came and no one knew who they were and they looked a bit rough, and so people didn't really want to speak to them. These were people who were supposed to be enlisted for their active duty in the, during the Holy Defense, and Dr. Mustafa Chamran was totally different. He sort of went up to them and sort of greeted them, embraced them one by one. And this is something we see also with other martyrs, for example, martyrs of service, for example, the former president of Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi. He once went up to sort of just the workers who were sort of the who would repair the cars for the organization. He was the Office of Inspection, and he went up and greeted one, and so it was really kind. So this is the sort of attitude we need to really take on board. Welcome back to A to Z here on IB English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about this idea that we treat people well. We need to be really courteous and kind, just the way our martyrs, whether the martyrs of a holy defense, whether the martyrs of service, of national service. So what do we do? So we need to be so humble that we treat people well regardless of their position. So, for example, you can imagine that. So that means, for example, we don't just show great courtesy, for example, to the, let's say, our superior in the organization we work with, so our boss. Maybe also when we're going shopping at our local supermarket, we can have that same degree of let's say, courtesy and kindness towards the people. And so I would actually ask you to maybe actively think of examples in your life. Examples, and this is useful as a little exercise. So think of examples in your life where maybe you notice in yourself, maybe you've spoken to someone differently. And obviously we have to think of someone who, in a sense, has a sort of higher rank. So maybe you've met someone, let's say you've met someone who is, I don't know, could be anyone. Someone who's famous in the media, a media personality. It could be anyone, or like the director of a hospital, someone who has a higher rank. So think back to that. How did you speak with that person? And then think back to yourself, how do you speak with someone on the street, or if someone comes knocking at the door, maybe someone's collecting for something, or maybe it's a door knocking campaign during one of the election campaigns. It's just someone working in the local supermarket or shop, and think to yourself, well, how would I speak to them? Did I treat both of these people in the same way, with the same degree of courtesy and kindness. And obviously, if not, that means that, yeah, that, and obviously this is something I have to think about too. So we then need to think, okay, well, if we treat them differently, this is not good. So I pray that all of us can reflect on this and then maybe actually change our behaviors if we need to, inshallah. So I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AZ here on Iron Bridge Radio as well. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. I'm joined today by the investigative journalist and author, Matt Kennard. Matt, I just want to go back to what we were discussing before about the UK government's proscription of Hezbollah. Hezbollah has two government ministers in the Lebanese government. They're also a huge factor in Lebanese politics more broadly. Lebanon is a country which we surely want to be friendly with, and Hezbollah is part of a government there that we have diplomatic relations with.
It was quite explicitly the work of the Israel lobby in that case, because Lord Polak, who is kind of like the dean of the Israel lobby in this country, he did an interview which was posted on YouTube where he was talking about the Israel lobby's current concern, or it was then and still is, to get the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, prescribed in the same way. And he said, all we need to do is straight lobbying. With Hezbollah, it took us ages. So he's admitting that it was an Israel lobby thing. Then in Alan Duncan's diaries, he was a minister. He was a Tory minister for the Americas and Europe from 2016 to 19. He was a Tory minister when the prescription happened. And he said, like, he was in the Commons, and he said that Israel's troops in the Commons have got this done. Sajid Javid, Priti Patel, others. He says that explicitly in his diaries. And Alan Duncan is not a fringe figure or conspiracy theorist. In fact, yeah, he's got odious politics in many things, but his position on Israel is just that he wants Britain to be a sovereign country.
Like, well, 100%, and he has skin in the game, because Shai Massar,
exactly,
as the Israeli spy, he was kicked out of Britain, was trying to bring down Alan Duncan. And you mentioned that he's not a fringe figure. He was a close ally of Theresa May and was, you know, a minister in her government. And his diaries are quite stark, actually, in terms of the, you know, the influence and control, at least within the Conservative Party, that he describes the Israel lobby wielding in Parliament.
Yeah, I actually think it's the best window we have into it. I read the whole book and did a story for Declassified at the time about what it revealed about the Israel lobby. And I mean, it's shocking, even for someone who is aware of the level of penetration. I mean, there's a line where he's talking to the permanent undersecretary in the Foreign Office, and he says something along the lines of, the Israelis think they control the Foreign Office, and they do. That's the quote. Obviously, that quote never got into the mainstream media. And he talks about the case with Shai Massar. He talks about the prescription of Hezbollah. And he talks about the fact that even his position that he was appointed to in Theresa May's cabinet, right? He was, as I mentioned, he was Minister for the Americas and Europe from 2016 to 2019. Now, he was originally slated to be Minister for the Middle East because he's known as the Middle East guy. He's a good friend of all the Gulf dictators, and he's that very sort of Arabist Foreign Office. And in his diaries, he goes through the process of, like, Boris Johnson approves it, Theresa May approves it, and then they get a call from Lord Polak. This is Theresa May or her personal assistant. And they, Lord Polak and Eric Pickles, and they say, you can't appoint Alan Duncan, Minister for the Middle East. And Alan Duncan sort of saying, well, this is the Prime Minister of Britain. She's going to tell them to go away. She doesn't. She then informs Boris Johnson, who's his boss at the time, he's Foreign Secretary, oh, we can't appoint you the Middle East Minister. And then Alan Duncan's shocked, and he's like, well, can't we just say that I'll be Middle East Minister, but we'll leave out the brief of Israel-Palestine? So they're basically trying to carve out Israel-Palestine because to accede to the Israel lobby. So they put that back, and that gets rejected. And they say, sorry, we can't appoint you Middle East Minister. We're going to have to appoint you Minister for the Europe and Americas. So what you have in that case, and Boris Johnson, by the way, one of the quotes that in this conversation, he said, the Israelis always do this. How can they get away with this? Even Boris Johnson is aware of it privately, you know, and talks about it. But what you have there is a situation where agents of a foreign regime, because they are Lord Polak is basically working for Israel within the UK, are overruling the democratically elected prime minister of the country. And that's just from a phone call. That is a shocking state of affairs. And from his diaries, it's also clear that everyone within the Foreign Office is aware of this. Like, they can't say it publicly, but he does. But the other important thing about it is what does Alan Duncan think? This is an old school Tory guy. He's basically, his official position is the same position as the UK government, which is that settlements need to go, there should be a two-state solution. Blah, blah. That's all he says. He's not radical in any way. He's not an anti-Zionist. He's a moderate. He's the same as the Conservative Party on their official policy. But that's too much for the Israel lobby. And that's what people need to understand about Zionism, its various different agencies here, is that it's a maximalist ideology. It only tolerates complete submission. And complete submission in this case means that you can't support a two-state solution because they never have supported the two-state solution, really. They're not going to tolerate a Palestine on its borders with a military or any kind of independence, and independent intelligence agencies or anything. It's not going to happen. So anyone even vocalizing, the crime is to vocalize the government's official position. And if you go for that and destroy him, which is what Shaima said, it was exposed, then you can maintain this kind of complete control. And then they tried to use the other mechanism against Anna Duncan when he left government. There was a whole investigation of him for anti-Semitism, of which he was eventually cleared. But again, it is quite a revealing study in how the Israel lobby in this country, how powerful it is, but also how it operates.
Well, their modus operandi is that a threat to Israel anywhere, no matter how small, is a direct threat to the continuation of their colonial state. And so they have this completely maximalist, as you said, way of operating, in which they will try to ground people who speak against them into fine dust, whatever they're saying or whatever they're doing. Well, of course, you know, they're now badly losing the propaganda war, but this is obviously the nature of the sort of forces that are ranged against us, at least, you know, from a British perspective. And I want to take this conversation now into this new left-wing party, which is going to be created under the stewardship of Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. Many people, myself included, have expressed concerns about mistakes that were made when Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party between 2015 and April 2020. For my part, you know, I was an active member of that pro-Corbyn movement at the time. I worked for a pro-Corbyn member of Parliament, and especially towards the end, I started to notice that Corbyn and the people around him were making terrible decision after terrible decision, particularly around the anti-Semitism smear campaign. And perhaps the worst incident was when a pamphlet was circulated in 2018 to all Labour Party members, which was written by someone who worked in Corbyn's office, which said, for many Jews, Zionism represents national liberation. The concepts of Israel, Zion, and Jerusalem run deeply in Jewish religion, identity, and culture. It said, the sensitivities around these concepts should be considered before using them. It also said, Labour is a political home for Zionists and anti-Zionists. Neither Zionism nor anti-Zionism is in itself racism. Now, looking at this in 2025, after 2 years of genocide, that sounds absolutely horrific. But of course, it was horrific at the time. And this sort of Jewish supremacism was a hallmark of that era. So surely after everything that we've experienced in this new party, anti-Zionism, real anti-Zionism, is an absolute red line.
Yeah, I think it should. And I think we're in a new period in terms of attitudes to Zionism, and the new party needs to reflect that. That's absurd, what you just read out, and immoral as well. But I think it was reflective of the time. You couldn't say anything. Like, people like me and you, we were talking about Zionism at that point, and the fact that the anti-Semitism campaign was a campaign and it was bogus, but we were completely marginalized, called cranks. There was,
we spoke about it in quite mild terms, I should say.
I know, yeah.
We weren't like radical, pioneering anti-Zionists, which I would say against me as well. I would say, not to exculpate myself.
I know.
From what happened during that period. Of course, we were making a stand, but it was quite a mild stand.
And actually, I said this when the genocide started. I said, I feel guilty, and I think we all failed because of that. Because it wasn't a conscious fear, but I was asking myself, why have I not been more outspoken on this? Obviously, I talked about Zionism and the fact I was anti-Zionist, but the debate was so controlled that anything you said was what made you appear completely off the charts. But I do think that's changed now, right? That has changed. And in fact, when the genocide started, I was saying to friends and other journalists, like, this is an opening. I mean, it's a horrific opening, but this is an opening now that we need to get rid of that red line that there has been for so long about Zionism, because that red line is imposed by the Zionist entity. So if you're acceding to it, then you're playing by the rules of that entity. And the reason it's protected is because it's indefensible. So once you start scratching the surface, once you start critically analyzing it, you realize it's completely at odds with any kind of progressive understanding of the world. And that's why it has to be protected. You know, it's a settler colonial ideology. It's an ideology which uses hijacks religion to support the imposition of a settler